American people deserve better. They deserve an attorney general who is accountable.
You read about the economic challenges newspapers everywhere face. We are not immune from those trends.
There can be no going back on the democratic transition called for by the Egyptian people.
How to grow the economy, how to create good jobs, how to pay down our deficit.
How to pay down our deficit. One of the stories, one of the speeches that we heard this week. It's Friday on The Takeaway, which means it's time to look back at the big stories of the week and maybe the not-so-big stories that still are driving the news cycle. Joining us now, Jeff Yang. He writes the Dow Jones column for The Wall Street Journal and blogs for WNYC's It's a Free Country. And also in the studio, both of you in the studio. What a treat for me, Farai Jadea, journalist and fellow at Harvard University's Institute of Politics. Let's just begin with something that was mind-boggling to me. Jamie Dimon goes up to Capitol Hill to apologize for a $3 billion loss, okay? J.P. Morgan Chase bought Washington Mutual. Do you guys want to know why Washington Mutual fell apart and went bankrupt? Because they lost $3 billion. Washington Mutual was bought by J.P. Morgan Chase, and here Jamie Dimon makes the same mistake, goes up to Capitol Hill. It seems like there's no accountability, and it all happens on the same day that Alan Stanford, the Ponzi schemer, is sentenced to 110 years in prison. I thought these were shocking, but I thought both stories were really in the background, Farai?
Well, you know, it's last night I had a chance to go to an interesting event, which was a lecture by Neil Ferguson, who's a Harvard professor and sort of economic contrarian. And he made a whole point of saying that he wanted less regulation and simpler regulation. And yet he wanted bad bankers to go to jail. So it, in this sense, you obviously have this Ponzi schemer, Stanford, getting a huge jail term. But if you talk about the mortgage crisis, if you talk about the other failures of American banking and sort of the black box banking, people don't really go to jail for that. I mean, it's fascinating. Like, you can have an individual Ponzi scheme and you can have, like, the book thrown at you. But
it's $7 billion. Stanford lost $7 billion for investors in the Ponzi scheme.
That is true. But if you talk about the failures of the American banking system, as a whole, there has been a lot more lost, and so that's not being punished.
So, Jeff, sort this out. Mm-hmm. Dow is your thing, right?
Yes.
So it's okay to turn the entire banking system into a casino, but just to have a Ponzi scheme, that's illegal.
Well, you know, that's the craziest thing about the way that we define, quote-unquote, regulation, right? I mean, regulation is supposed to be creating a level playing field, a way where everybody who follows the rules, you know, is going to avoid acting in ways that are effectively criminal. But so much of the financial system is about trying to stretch and test and push the limits of even the weak regulations we have already. And it seems so much like we set it up so the incentives are to play chicken. And I think that when you look at what Neil Ferguson and others are saying about the fact that, you know, yes, of course we want to catch the bad guys, but we can't grow unless we have essentially unfettered market activity, it almost sounds like they want bad actors to voluntarily put themselves in jail. I mean, they want them to police themselves, and they want them to decide amongst themselves that there are some people straight over the line.
You know, I find academically and in the political sphere, the level of economic discourse is really unsophisticated right now. It's almost as though they're afraid to mess with the system. They want to go back to the market, but they have some idea that, oh, the bad people, when we see them, will cart them off to jail. It just doesn't work that way. Did either of you hear an coherent economic vision from Mitt Romney or President Obama this week?
No, but what I did hear was a tactical shift on the from the Obama camp that should have probably happened at least a year ago, which, I mean, if you're going to fight on the ground, so President Obama in his, you know, nearly hour-long economic speech made the point that he inherited a messed up economy. That is totally true. And what you're hearing this because the jobs numbers have continued to be dismal. But you can't fight on the ground of it's getting better, it's getting better, it's getting better. Oh, wait. Bush messed it up. You know, it's kind of like there's a temporal inversion that's happened here where he is right, but the timing is off.
And part of the issue, and you've blogged about this, is if your campaign strategy and your presidential strategy is to try to fix the system, to blame it on the previous administration, but not to aggressively deliver to progressive groups who are mm-hmm. really your core constituency, it's going to feel tepid, right?
Yeah. I mean, on the other hand, Mitt Romney, his speech included this backhanded tax because he talked about basically, having goods against China under some kind of a trade tax, which would be a tax that falls on Americans, which means that stuff at Walmart would cost more. That's the shorthand. Stuff at Walmart will cost more if Mitt Romney is elected president.
Huge tax cuts, right?
Yeah, exactly. While the tax cuts on the wealthy continue.
Jeff Yang, your analysis of the compare and contrast here.
Well, I think the biggest thing about Obama's speech was a sense that not just that it should have been, given a year ago effectively, but that there was no real new news there, that he was restating what he already essentially put down as his playing cards, his hand. It's not a super strong hand given the optics of all this, which is that, yes, he's going to invest in the future, and yes, he's going to uplift the middle class and focus on, kind of restarting the stalled economy, whereas Mitt Romney, meanwhile, is going to give handouts to his friends. And of course, I mean, that's a strong position, but in order to really underscore that, he needs a vision. He needs to actually carve out some sort of strategy that's more than just saying, we're doing this, we're going to do more of it. And I think also, given the fact that Romney seems to be pretty much entrenched in this notion of, I'm going to go toe-to-toe. Everywhere you are, I'm going to be as well, and I'm going to drive around you honking horns and so forth. There is an argument to be made that I think is direct as well. He should be going straight at Romney's, policy throat, if you will, and say, if you think that you have a better plan or a plan at all, outline it and be specific. He alludes to it. He says, well, these guys have said they're going to cut things in the government. They aren't really saying what those are. Demand that. The people deserve that.
So you think Obama should be much more aggressive on demanding specifics from Romney on programmatic things. But let's talk about the vision for a second to both of you, and then we'll move on because you've got some other interesting things to talk about. Is this a vision moment? Is this a moment where you can even come up with a vision? I'm having a little difficulty.
Well, again, it gets back to timing. I worry that it's too late in the election cycle for anyone, the president, Congress, anybody, to really shift the jobs numbers using political means. The only shift that could have happened early in the Obama presidency would have been to make a case, which the Republicans never would have gone along with, but you could have, with the early Democratic majority, pushed through for public job support.
Bigger
stimulus and a different kind of stimulus, not just focused on infrastructure and road work, but also on teachers. And, Paul
FDR
Krugman
style.
Of the New York Times has been writing a lot about what are public employees. They're the people who make our lives work. That's one argument. Other people would argue differently. But again, I just worry the moment has passed for something like that. That's the only thing because you've seen an increase in private employment, but the continued decrease in public.
All right. So vision, maybe not in 2012. Jeff, you looked at your iPhone this week and discovered a giant cultural shift going on in America.
Yeah. This is something people have been talking about, of course, which is that as with most things, you can learn more about the world by looking at computer icons and graffiti than headlines. And in this case, they included Apple included for the first time a set of emoticons that depict gay couples in their new version of iOS, which of course makes a ton of sense, not only because the world is shifting in that direction, but because the new CEO of Apple is the most prominent out gay man in the Fortune 500, in corporate America, period. And I think what you're seeing is that the temperature shift that we're reading in America as a whole, in kind of just mass opinion, it is finally being reflected with people at the top of the ladder.
Yeah, interesting.
Actually being represented.
This is being driven aggressively. And we're seeing
Absolutely.
It with Obama and we're seeing it with Apple. Okay, Fry, any chance that Eric Holder is going to find you behind the leaks that the administration is investigating on some of these national security matters?
Yeah, no. I had a leak in my shower once, but that's about as far as I go with the leaks. I think that Attorney General Holder is is besieged from many points. You know, he is a target of Republican ire. I myself don't know enough to judge, you know, the idea, of course, is that these leaks, you know, about some of the Obama administration's policies are
compromise national security in a way of pumping up Obama's reputation.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. I don't know that that would be a wise strategy if, in fact, that was what he had done.